सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
जी हसन साहब, कुछ थोड़ा सा विल यू से समथिंग टू इंट्रोड्यूस योर सेल्फ, योर बैकग्राउंड, योर एजुकेशनल बैकग्राउंड, व्हाट यू आर डूइंग, यू हैव बीन टीचिंग एट पाकिस्तानी यूनिवर्सिटीज, सो लिटिल बिट अबाउट दैट।
So I teach political science back at the University of Peshawar in Pakistan. I am a former student of the same department where I was teaching. I also did an MPhil from the Qaid-e-Azam University in Islamabad. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I am on a Fulbright grant studying in the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Mm-hmm. And in particular, my focus is on counterterrorism and with a specific focus then on developing counter narratives to the prevailing extremist narratives that we have in our society.
Okay, that sounds excellent. So basically you are trying to study counterterrorism, global governance, and how it impacts our societies. That's excellent. Very good. Tell me, I think that you had an article in the newspapers recently on the Mashal Khan incident. So maybe you could tell us something about the Mashal Khan incident, since you come from closer to that incident than most of us are, and then tell us what your argument was in that article.
As far as the facts of the case go, I know as much as probably you do or anyone else, because most of the facts came to us through the media. So I understand there is a political dimension to it. People were saying that Mashal Khan had an issue with the way the university administration was being run, and especially with regard to the issue of the appointment of a full-time vice chancellor of the university. So I kept that issue to one side and just focused on the issue on which Mashal Khan was actually barbarically killed, and that was the issue of a concocted issue rather of blasphemy. So my own opinion, and this came to me as a shock, as it came to a lot of other people, that such a thing could happen at an institution of higher education. Now, as you know, higher education institutions are generally understood to be more open than the societies within which these higher education institutions exist. And therefore, we as educated people, as people who've taught in these institutions, as people who've learned from these institutions, we expect these institutions to be a place for open debate, for open discussion, for opposing views, for greater tolerance. So this came to me as a shock. And then I sat down and I thought about what prompted these fellow students to one day rise up and then murder one of their own in such a brutal manner. And when I thought about it, I thought, for me, it represented a failure. Mm-hmm. For me as a professor, although I've never taught in that particular university, but coming from that area, being part of the same education system. And when I thought about it, obviously I put a lot of blame on the higher education. But then I also thought that the higher education also needed defense from someone like me, who has been part and parcel of that system and who understood the challenges within which the higher education in Pakistan operates. So there were three, four major things that came to my mind. One, of course, higher education or higher education institution exists within the broader societies, and the dominant discourses in that societies and the prevailing dogma within that societies determines what we can and cannot say, what we can and cannot teach within university. So that was one thing. The second thing was, of course, access to technology in the universities. When you come from a college in Pakistan to university, there isn't that much of a difference between the two levels. It's like you're going to the college one year and you're going to the university another year. The mindset isn't much different, and I attribute much of that to the lack of access that we have in our universities to technology. The third thing that I think we do not focus so much on is a lack of quality public sector schools and colleges, especially in Tepi. I'm not sure how it is in Punjab and other places, but that's where we get our students from. And I thought that unless there is greater focus on schools and on colleges, I don't see how we get better lot in universities, and how my impact as a professor in these universities can increase. And lastly, and I think most importantly, was our own openness to critical thinking. For us as professors, as students, and as a society, this openness that we should only form our opinion, form our mind about something after we have some facts and some understanding of a certain situation. I think these were some of the things that I wrote about in the piece that I did.
So briefly, you're saying basically that it is the quality of the public sector university itself, mm-hmm. the openness to critical thinking, the intake that you take, that they're coming from a background that you cannot obviously address very quickly, and then the level of technology that you have available at your fingertips. Is that a good summary, or would you like to add something?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely, yes.
So if you have that, let me think about it. Yeah, okay, fair enough. I agree with you that the student intake that comes from public schools, we have a lot of evidence to suggest that public schools are not doing a good job. But then there are a large number of private schools too, which I believe are doing a good job, and they do send some good students to you. So let's put it this way, that roughly the ratio now of public-private schools is 30-70. So 30% of your students must be fairly well taught, fairly good. But I think what you're probably referring to is the extent of fundamentalism in the students. It seems that generally the students come with a fundamentalist mindset, which also adds to the fact that they that mindset is not open to critical thinking, and that also gives you a crop that is not ready to be fertilized properly. Is that the case?
It is, of course, definitely.
So and your students that are coming to you are generally imbued by a sense of uncritical thinking and imbued by a sense of reverence to fundamentalist thought. Is that right?
That absolutely is correct, yes.
Okay. Now when they come to your university, how do you address that situation? What do you do? First of all, maybe before you do that, can you tell me a little bit about, let's say, your university, Peshawar University? Let's just talk about that for a minute. How many students do you have?
So we in the master's classes have about approximately 60 students in the morning in one session, and then we have 60 in the evening. Mm-hmm. So about 120 students in what we call MA Previous, mm-hmm. which is the first year of MA, and then about as many in MA Final.
And how many classes do you have to take? As a professor, how many classes did you have to teach?
I think approximate on average, I would teach two master's classes, mm-hmm. and one classes at the BS level. I was coming to that, which is a 4 years program. So you have about 30 students for each year.
Okay.
So
and this is every week.
We have about 5 hours per credit for master's, which means that I would teach on average 3 hours per day. Yeah.
3 hours per day.
Per day, yeah. That's,
for the master's and the BA?
No, that's overall.
Overall.
I'm saying.
Teaching roughly about 15 hours a week?
That's true, yes.
That's right? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, can you also tell me in your university, what is the total number of students?
I wouldn't really be well placed to make an estimate like that, but we have about 50 departments. Uh-huh. So you can put it together. I think the regular students would go somewhere around 10 to 20,000, somewhere
okay.
around that.
So yeah. It's a fairly large university. Okay. Now, just tell me, how many professors do you have in your department? What is the total size of your faculty?
We have, at this point, 10 or 11 full-time faculty members.
Full-time faculty. Out of them, how many are professors?
When you say professors in Pakistani context, I'm sure you understand, but if your listeners understand or not, a professor would be someone who would be the most senior faculty member in the department. Yeah. So we have five professors, yes, in our department. Yeah.
Five professors, huh? Full professors.
Five full professors, yes.
With PhDs and publications according to the HEC.
Yeah, I think Everyone in the department, except for two relatively young professors, myself included, mm-hmm. have PhDs, yes. Okay. So about nine members of our faculty. And I think about six of them must have foreign PhDs, yeah.
Okay. Now, tell me, how many, apart from classes, what other activities do you have in your department?
So for one thing, everyone has to be involved in the administrative responsibilities to an extent. For example, I was doing the coordinatorship for the BS program before I came to the US for my PhD studies. So the chair, there is always someone who has to chair the department. There are coordinators for the master's program and for the MPhil programs. So all of us have to share the administrative responsibilities. And then we do organize regular conferences at the department. So someone has to take responsibility for the international conferences and for the summer schools. So everyone is involved in these administrative.
No, but I'm looking at it from the point of view of the students. For example, the students mm-hmm. who attend your classes, after classes, do they have any other lectures? Do they have people coming in to give seminars? Or like, for example, you're at UMass. I'm sure there are lots of extracurricular lectures, seminars, and all kinds of things. Do you have anything like that?
We do and we do not depend. So we do in the sense that it really boils down a lot to who runs the department, who heads the department, and how dynamic that person is in themselves. Because students do not get credit for attending seminars, which happens in the Western universities sometimes. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when we have a dynamic head of the department, you would have seminars at least once a month. Mm-hmm. But that really depends. In our okay. department, we've been more fortunate than some other ones. Mm-hmm. We've been more vibrant than others. Mm-hmm. But no, there is no no specific number of seminars that you have to do or you do have.
No, even if you don't have to do them, I'm not saying compulsory, but most universities that I've been to, they yes. don't have compulsory seminars or lectures. Yeah. But yeah. there are a wide number of extracurricular lectures and seminars that people can go to if they want to. There's no compulsion, but they can go to if they want to. And that serves as an extra level of education that they can attend, right? Because they have to do a course, they have to do the coursework, which is prescribed syllabus. But then all sure. of a sudden, somebody might come along and, let's say, talk about global governance that you're studying, or somebody might come along and talk about, let's say, the Trump phenomenon, or somebody might come along mm-hmm. and talk about, let's say, the climate change or whatever. And students can interact with that person, and students can get another a whole new set of education through these extracurricular activities. And we don't have that in our universities, right?
We do. Again, it's this brings me to a rather interesting anecdote. Yeah. So I have a friend who teaches at Wellesley College here mm-hmm. in Mass. I don't know if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. It's an all women. Yeah, it's yeah. For your audience. Yeah. It's a fairly prestigious college. Mm-hmm. So my friend who is a professor here, he was visiting the University of Peshawar, and then we thought it was a good idea for him to speak to our students, like you said. It opens up an avenue for the student to speak to an American professor face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So now most of his work is on Muslim philanthropy in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. You might actually be maybe familiar with his name, Christopher Candland, because he happens to be a political economist. So mm-hmm. So now Chris came in and he spoke about the volume of zakat and charity that people in Pakistan do in the name of religion mm-hmm. to organizations like the ED Foundation and stuff. Now you would as an expert you would expect that now when students sit, they would ask him questions about that issue. The main question that I had, for instance, in mind was if we had such huge amount, volume of philanthropy happening in Pakistan, why is the tax collection so low? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the question that I had. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what happened was when we opened the floor for the students to start asking questions, mm-hmm. everyone started asking questions on why the U.S. was involved in drone attacks, why that particular professor had come to Pakistan, was he an agent with the CIA, okay. Was he an agent of secularism, was he part of some New World Order? So again, and that put that professor in a rather tricky position, yeah. because now if he starts defending his own position, it would seem like he was trying to defend the American position on these issues. Mm. And he would, if the professor wouldn't, it would seem like he, in a way, is trying to justify.
So basically what you're telling me is that the students, because they don't, in a sense, they haven't been sort of, they have no experience really in dealing with speakers and in question and answer sessions. They obviously get aggressive, they're raw, and they will ask all kinds of strange questions. But that's why I'm saying that the way I look at it is that I remember when I first went to LSE, yes, I was raw and I didn't know how to ask a question. You need to habituate students to asking questions, and that's part of critical thinking. And you said, you know, you yourself admitted there's no critical thinking, but one way to begin critical thinking is to increase the student's exposure. And what I find very troubling is, because I try and go to universities, Pakistani universities, and give talks, extracurricular talks, and I find that the faculty is resistant to that phenomenon. They really don't want the extracurricular talks to be held. Right.
Yeah.
And when I give a talk, and I take some friend to give a talk, whatever, I mean, there are lots of good people who can give talks. I find that the faculty is the most resistant. Sometimes they will not even turn up. Right.
Yeah.
They give the student a clear signal that I don't need to turn up. Right. Now, when you say critical thinking, the critical thinking is something that you acquire in a university from the atmosphere. That's why I'm asking you all these questions, to try and get at the atmosphere of the university. If you have this thing that, okay, one class comes in the morning, one in the evening, you teach your lecture and then you go away, and the students are left to just hang around the tuck shop or do nothing, obviously they're not going to imbibe anything. That's why universities have activities like extracurricular lectures. For example, in your universities, do you have any movies or any other activity that students can engage in?
I think we do once a year the Mushaira. Uh-huh. Or stuff like that. So, and then there are the usual welcome farewell parties for students, by students. Okay. So we do have these.
But I'm talking about intellectual activities, for example.
Not enough. No, not nearly enough.
Let's say, you know, like most, I remember my daughter was studying in UPenn, and they had almost a daily movie that they would see. And then they would discuss and somebody would critique it. That's not part of coursework. That's totally outside coursework as a part of society. For example, do you have intellectual societies? Like, let's say the Philosophical Society, or let's say the Film Society, or let's say the Media Society, or let's say whatever, you know, International Relations or Model UN or something. Do you have these things?
So these societies, we have them at the provost's office, various societies, the Adventure and Hiking Club, the Media Society, societies focusing on film. And then we have the student associations at the department level, like the Political Science Association for the students of political science, IRSA for the international students body, international relations student body. But again, one, like you said, the faculty usually tends to be, maybe it's because people think that they're overworked. It's maybe because the priorities that professors themselves think that, since they're being paid for the teaching and anything that they would do other than teaching, since they're not, it's not their primary responsibility, why indulge in something like that? Can be anything. But we do have societies in name, in there's this nomenclature, like I mentioned to you. But there aren't enough activities that happen in these societies. And even if they do, the number of students that are involved in them is then only a small portion of the whole student body that we have at the department.
What about student magazines and, you know, student debating societies and things like that?
Oh, yes, again, we do. So we at the Department of Political Science, for instance, and I'm going back again and again to that because that's where my experience comes from. We have a magazine called The Leader, which is for students to contribute and write in it. When I was there, we were doing it once a year, which I think isn't enough for everyone to contribute to it. But still, it was there. But again, I would want something more robust, something that happens with a lot more frequency. something that involves teachers a lot more. Mm. So that's what I think is missing. The fundamentals are there. Mm. There are the societies. Mm. There are the students' bodies. There are the magazines. Mm. It's only that we need to invest more in them. Mm. We need to give them more time. Maybe we need to free professors off of some of their teaching responsibilities, so that they could focus more on these things. Mm. But that's what I would want to get into. Yes.
Okay, so let's back up a little now. As you said, that you have a crop of students that comes into your university, that comes in from schools where they have not been well prepared, where they are not engaged in critical thinking, and they may also have within them deeply religious roots or fundamentalist roots, because that's the kind of thought process that was inculcated in them, right? Sure. Now they come to you, and they come to an university atmosphere where the professors or the lecturers are just engaged in teaching and then going away, and the students have very little else that they can do. They don't have seminars, public lectures. They don't have, I mean, for example, I can think of a number of people. I mean, even a number of retired bureaucrats who could come and give long, very nice talks that could really inform them a lot of things. Or retired judges, for example, or, you know, tons of people like myself who come in from there, from outside, lots of visiting professors who pass by. I can honestly, I was the vice chancellor of PID, and I started this seminar series. I forced them to do it, and for 11 years it's been running regularly every week, and sometimes twice or thrice a week, because I said, look, this has to run. And now they are running it regularly, two or three times a week sometimes, because we just catch hold of whoever's coming by and we say, come on, give a talk. And students have now figured out that they should attend, and they're attending. So that's good. So I think the thing is that if we, our universities, thought that this was another important form of education, especially to bring out critical thinking and set up these things, allowed students to set up these things, let them use their initiative, run it. For example, school magazines. Why should the school magazine come out once a year? It should come out once a month, maybe once a week. Right? Or, for example, do you allow students, is there a university blog? Is the university website good?
No, there is no blog. I don't think the university website updates sufficiently enough for students to get enough information about these things.
Think about it. If students could engage in technology, do blogs or something. I mean, for example, this podcast that we are doing, students could do this podcast. In fact, I want to give this to a student, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The point is, if you want them to be thinking critically, they have to be engaged in critical activities.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we have to take the risk. We have to let them do blogs. We have to let them do this. We have to let them do that. Yes, they'll make mistakes.
Yeah.
We all make mistakes. You and I make mistakes too. They might learn something, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if that doesn't happen, the most important thing, correct me if I'm wrong, do the students feel that they have adequate mentoring in, or for example, when you were a student, do you feel you got good mentoring from your faculty? Did you find good mentors in your faculty, people who could engage with you and broaden your horizons, offer you suggestions, engage with you in critical thinking, give you ideas for future reading, allow you to question, and in fact facilitate your questioning of whatever you've learned?
I think I did, but not everyone does. And that was because of my own position in the department in relation with the faculty members. And especially because when faculty members who are studying abroad in the foreign countries, when they come back, you get a sense of them trying to give back to students a lot more than teachers, the same teachers even who've studied abroad, being in the profession for a long time. So we were fortunate that when we were in the department, when I was still in my master's, there were some faculty members who had recently returned from abroad. And I don't know, maybe when they come back, there's a greater optimism and we beat it out of them over time. So maybe I was one of those people who were fortunate at that time to benefit from certain professors, from mentoring.
Now that's a very interesting thing that you said. You're saying that a faculty member who, like yourself, for example, you're here now studying at at UMass.
Yeah.
When you go back, you will have a greater enthusiasm, rightly so. You've come out fresh of a university. you have fresh ideas, you'll go back and you'll try and engage students better. So you will be motivated as well as enthusiastic as well as well endowed to be able to give adequate mentoring. But over time, let's say in 5, 10 years time, 15 years time, your enthusiasm will dry up, your knowledge will depreciate, you will lose the touch with students and you'll tend to back off and say, let them be. Right. Yeah. So in a sense, the is the university administration aware of this, and are they reseeding the faculty all the time or not?
No. So again, that's something that I raised at some point. One, when we recruit professors even, and maybe this happens in every university, you know that with Pakistani bureaucracy, there is an elaborate system of training before you actually join the service. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing for universities. Mm-hmm. Although, as opposed to the, for example, the superior civil services in Pakistan, where people are inducted in BPS 17, the professors at the university, the lecturers actually, are now inducted in BPS 18, mm-hmm. Which is actually a step higher than bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. But still, there is no training. You're inducted one day. Next day, you would go to the class and start teaching. Which is something which I find completely inexplicable, because if I have been a good student, if I was able to pass a test for the lectureship, if I did good in the interview, who knows if I'm a good teacher or not? Mm-hmm. Who knows if I am a radical myself inside? Who knows what my mindset is? Mm-hmm. So for one thing, I think in the beginning of the service, there should be some form of training for university professors, mm-hmm. at least for a period of time, where they know what is required of a teacher, what critical thinking is, because we learn when we come to these other countries, but by then I've already taught for 7 years before I came to the U.S. What have I been doing for 7 years? I just common sense. It's just that you go with your gut feeling, but whether I did the right thing or not, who knows? So I think, for one thing, to begin with, we need training.
Okay, let me ask you another thing. Now, you've been at UMass for 3 years?
Yeah, I've been here for three years. Yes.
Just contrast the experience here with Pakistan, with your experience in Pakistan. If you just think about it very quickly, what are the two or three key things that strike you as the differences between Pakistan and here?
I think the first thing would be the teaching style. Mm-hmm. We in Pakistan spoon-feed a lot more than they do here. Here, the student would have to brush up on their skills and do the thing for themselves. Even if you're not up to scratch, you're going to fail a few courses and then you wouldn't be in the program anymore. In Pakistan, it's the teacher who has to do all the work. You come to the class prepared. Your students are taking notes. You're teaching them. Here, one or the other person in the class always is giving presentation. The professors are merely listening and correcting and maybe intervening, moderating the discussion. Never really the professor is the one who is running the show. So that I think is the, as a professor and as a student, that is the, I think, the most dominant thing that I saw. The other thing, I think you already mentioned it, is the kind of activities that students can engage in these universities and in the U.S. or elsewhere, as opposed to Pakistan, where here there are a lot more activities in which students are involved academically, in extracurricular, in co-curricular. Back home, not so much. So that's another thing that you see. Third, I think, again, you referred to it briefly, is the environment in the university as well. I'm here as a minority student, as in I'm a Muslim, I am an immigrant, I'm a Pakistani, I'm not from here. But when you go to the campus, you feel like you're part of the whole thing. You can say whatever you want to. You can be part of maybe a movement for something that the majority of this country does not believe in, but you can, with your own face, you can stand up in the corridor and you can maybe have a placard and say anything you want in the classroom, outside the classroom. In Pakistan, you do not get this kind of openness, even if you're a professor, let alone if you're a student. So I think these are two, three major, major differences that I see.
What about in terms of mentoring?
Again, because I am a PhD student, of course, mentoring it comes with it. I have a whole committee of professors who will look after me. And because PhD students, there are a few of them, so that can happen. So I cannot really speak for the master's students, but
I think you can think about it in terms of access to faculty.
Sure.
For example, look at the size of the faculty, the expertise of the faculty in the department, and each student, whether BA or MA, I think each student can approach a faculty member and ask questions, right? And the thing is that the faculty has so many different skills and seniority. For example, some senior professors, some junior professors, I mean, they have a depth of knowledge there. Do we have the same depth in Pakistan or not?
I wouldn't really comment on the depth of knowledge, because a lot of that depends on what a certain professor does, and some are better than others, I guess. But yes, here there's a lot more access to the professor. You get your teaching assistants and your research assistants who students can even speak with if they had problem. Again, even if you had psychological problem, counseling is a very, very common thing in the American universities. You can go to a psychologist if you think that you're struggling on account of some issue other than pure academics.
So you see, let me just sum up. I think the way the discussion is going, and what I learned from this, is that university is not just students sitting there and listening to a professor for an hour or two a day and then taking an exam. University is a composite whole with many things happening in it. Right? Yes, part of it is the professors teaching a certain core curriculum, which is important, not saying that at all. But then there are other things too. For example, extracurricular lectures, extracurricular activities, you know, the students also taking responsibility for themselves, the students standing up and making presentations, arguing with the professor.
Yes.
All these things inspire critical thinking. At the same time, as you said, the students' welfare is also of concern. So if they'll be under stress during examination, they'll be under stress when they're writing their dissertation. So yes, we need counseling too. Sure. So, I mean, when you think about it, a university is a very complex system with a lot of things happening in there. From teaching is only one part, but there's so many other things. Students learn not just from teaching. Students learn from interaction. Students learn from doing things themselves. Students learn from being self-sufficient. Yeah. Students learn from being inquiring. And you have to encourage all that, and it can't be done by any one person. It has to be done by the system as a whole.
Yeah.
Do you think that AGC and our university administrations are aware of this concept? Do they look at the university like this, or do they look at it only as a teaching machine?
Because I do not really know much about the HEC, their vision and their bureaucracy and the way they operate. But just to give you an example on the, maybe on the financial side, but then that would explain the input from the professors in what the government does. So you must have heard about the laptop scheme in the various provinces, the provincial universities of Pakistan. And so because, just like in the beginning, I mentioned that I had been the coordinator for the BS program. So I was the one who would approve whether a certain student had the requisite score in their semesters. So that they would become eligible for the laptop program. And I think about 60-70% of our BS students got laptops through the provincial chief minister scheme in the last coming. But I was always puzzled by the fact that I was never consulted, or anyone in my faculty was never consulted, whether our BS students even needed laptops. One thing, whether we had access to computers or not in my department. And the other thing was that on the one hand, the government was giving students laptops, but on the other hand, they were not giving us funds, and we used to be the HEC was running that whole thing. The professors used to be on the roads and blocking the roads and stuff to get funds from the HEC. So I did not really understand the profligacy of the whole system and the way the resources were being used. Because the BA students, for most part, do not involve in research. Hmm. So if you would ask me, I would say, yes, maybe if you give them free laptops, it's good for everyone. Hmm. But if you had such finances, maybe we could subsidize good the point. Tuition fee that yeah. that we were charging them.
Yeah.
So I think it's as stakeholders, when you come
with
education.
So I think that example that you gave is very interesting, because what it shows is that, and this is what I was trying to get at, that who is imagining or envisioning the system, who is planning, who is thinking about the system, that's why HEC is important. But forget the HEC, then the Vice Chancellor's Office is important, then the faculty is important. I mean, what are the visions of all the universities? I remember I was in the Planning Commission, and I interacted with the universities a lot. I used to ask them about their visions, and I couldn't get them to give me a vision. They would only say to provide high quality education. I said, that's not good enough. We have to have a much deeper vision, because everybody, all universities are not alike. They're different. Now, you are in Boston, UMass, Harvard, MIT. There's so many Northeastern, there's so many universities there, right? And you can tell that all of them are different. They're not the same at all. Right.
Yes,
so in Pakistan, also the universities must be different. They must come at their objective and their goal from a different point of view. And they should have different objectives, different goals.
Sure.
And they must all try and compete in different ways, not in the same way. And I don't see that happening in universities. And I think that may be the problem.
Yeah, no, because again, one, in Pakistan especially, because we are geographically different from one region to another, there are different kind of challenges. So my university is the largest university in the Pashtun region in Pakistan. I think, and also if you're counting the broader Pashtun region, including the Pashtuns in Afghanistan, it is the largest university in that sense. So it is catering not only to that city in which it is placed, which is the case with most American universities or some American universities, but it is catering to I think a few crore people in that in that region. So so that is one thing. Again, from the point of view of radicalization, again, we should have different goals than, for instance, Qaid-e-Azam University. We should have different vision than Qaid-e-Azam University. In terms of the kind of youth that we have, we should have different goals than, for instance, Karachi University. So you're right. It's the vision should be context specific. The capabilities should be context specific. The syllabus and everything should be geared towards then meeting that vision that the university
has. How many conferences did you arrange?
So, I mean, again, our department is especially fortunate because we have at least one international conference every summer. We do it on the Pashtun region, which is, and then we are the only department in the whole region, in the Pashtun region, that does an annual international summer school on conflict, which is open to students from Central Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and I think this year we've invited some students from India as well. I'm not really sure if they got
visas. Do you have faculty exchanges with other universities, let's say Islamabad University or other universities in Pakistan? Do you have faculty exchanges? Do you have student exchanges or not?
Not internally, no. But until recently, we were doing something with a university called Erfurt University in Germany.
Okay.
Again, it's a lot of this happens when your faculty members go abroad and they come back with their own connections. So because some of our faculty members went to these universities, they came back with Germany.
But it's random. It's not systematic.
It's not systematic. It is when I speak now to you about my own department, it's a very unique experience in
so
that.
Let me bring you back, Adnan, to this thing, which is very important. You remember we started off with Mashal Khan.
Yeah.
So let me bring you back to this, that in this environment where you have very little social activity, very little socializing, you just have a class and that's it, and you have very little other activities that will use your creative juices. You come at this environment with your background of poor schooling and fundamentalism, and that you are imbued, you know, youth is full of energy. You're imbued with this energy to do something, and that translates into some kind of religious zealotry.
Yeah.
In this environment, Mashal Khan, who comes in, And some kid who starts reading some things, like he's, I believe he started reading Dawkins and philosophy, etc. And he starts talking about it and he starts showing off, as kids do. I used to do that when I was growing up. I read something, I'd like to come and discuss it with my fellow students. And I like to argue with them. Yeah, that's part of youth. Is he not going to run into trouble if that happens?
That is true not only for students, but also for professors as well.
Right.
And I spoke with a few colleagues and all of them were now more, they are more circumspect in speaking their mind than they would be before that incident. Although we always knew that there was a there was an undercurrent to the society which can turn violent at any point. But for you to see it happen in real life, so close to where you're based.
In that sort of a situation, what role could the faculty or the administration play? The way I look at it is that if there had been a very good faculty, right? I think it's also important that the faculty itself must be respected by students, right? And if I don't know whether that happens in Pakistani universities or not, because I remember when I was studying, we really didn't have respect for the faculty, so to speak. And the faculty must be capable of engaging students with some authority, not just authority in terms of danda, but authorities in terms of being able to guide them through their own expertise and their own knowledge and the feeling that they are respectable, wise people, etc. So do you think that if Mashal Khan had recourse to such faculty and such administration, such people who could help him out in such a situation?
I think one, because that particular situation was very spontaneous. So that is one thing. Two, because here when you talk about faculty, we perhaps presume that all the faculty members are fairly enlightened, which is again problematic. Not everyone thinks the same way even in even in the faculty. I think I again it would be backstabbing my whole my own community when I say that, but maybe a lot of the professors in many of these universities would have similar mindset to the students who actually attacked Mashal Khan. So it's the radicalization of the society. With that, the problem is that it's not limited to the student body. It has permeated each and every aspect of the society, so, including
unlike in the Western world, where the universities became the bastion of free thinking, critical thinking, you know, developing open thought, our universities have not become that.
Unfortunately, not. I mean, until now, we have not. But the hope for me is that the younger professors who are joining the profession, they have had greater exposure. They, I think, from, and this is from experience, and I do not have the empirics to go with it, but this is what I've observed. There is a greater openness. There is a backlash against the discourse to which we've been held hostage in a way. So I see that there is a pushback. But again, because now with incidents like Mashal Khan's, even people who are open in their own thinking, I don't know, because I've not taught since, I've been here since then. I don't know how comfortable people are speaking their mind in the classroom right now.
Thank you, Amir. I think we've had a very good discussion. I think the importance of your discussion is that you've taken us into a Pakistani university. You've given us insights into the Pakistani university, into the Pakistani students' mindset. And the picture, I'm afraid, is not very comforting. I think this, from my what I gather from your experiences, that there's probably far more radicalization and uncritical thinking and other issues still permeating our universities, which need to be tackled. My view is to tackle them is a very difficult thing, and unless we start building a university ecosystem, not just teaching places. Unless we start building a university ecosystem of thinking, as you said, critical thinking, of questioning, of inquiry, which comes when you, it's not easy to do. I don't think it'll happen overnight, but unless the university administration, the faculties, the HEC begins to think along those lines, that university, they're not just publication mills, or university is not a teaching mill. It's an ecosystem of critical thinking, and that ecosystem requires a lot of inputs. Mm-hmm. Public lectures, it's seminars, it's magazines, it's seeing movies, it's letting student societies form, it's allowing people to understand that the most important thing, in fact, the most holy thing you can do is critical thinking. For even the Quran says that you must engage in critical thinking.
Exactly, right? Yes.
And unless we can somehow start that process, we will not achieve a level of higher education that we want to. Would you say that's a good summing up? Is that where we should end?
That's exactly true, yes.
Okay, wonderful, Amir. Wonderful to talk to you. And let's do another one soon, something on another subject, okay?
Thanks so much. Yeah, it was.
Okay, Amir, before we go, can you recommend a book? I normally ask guests to recommend a book that our listeners should read, a book that has influenced you a lot.
I think recently I've read a book by an Israeli professor with the last name Harari. The book is called Homo Deus. It deals with a lot of interesting questions concerning not only the human biological evolution, but also with the intellectual evolution and how societies became what they are right now. So yeah, definitely, I would recommend it to each and every one.
Great choice, wonderful. Have you read his earlier book too, Sapiens?
Sapien, I did, but this one in particular impressed me because it deals more with the future. Yeah.
They're both very good books, so I admire and recommend your suggestion. Yeah. Thank you very much. All the best. Bye bye.
सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।